Welcome to SQ Radio. This is Susie Montgomery. Temple Grandin has been working from home since March, when the COVID-19 pandemic started quickly spreading across the United States and the world.
Everything has been canceled since March 12th. Everything. And my September's all canceled out. My October's canceling out. All my speaking engagements. That's all I used to do is speak engagements. They're all going online or they're canceled.
Sherry and Temple's longtime friend, Rosalie Winard, talked to Grandin on a Zoom video call about her research and how her autism and visual thinking gives us a unique perspective on the current pandemic. For those of you that might not know, Grandin is often called upon for her now famous way of seeing the world in pictures, which leads her to crafting solutions that to her are simple and obvious.
Temple Grandin is a professor of animal science at Colorado State University. She gives talks across the world about her research on autism, animal behavior, and the humane design of livestock facilities. She has written numerous popular books and has published over 100 scientific and technical articles on livestock handling, since she's been home most of the time like the rest of us. She's been spending it in typical Grandin fashion, scouring lots of news articles and scientific and medical studies. She says she's gone deep into the literature on COVID-19.
This coronavirus, bats live with it. Doesn't make them sick. All right, now, so you take bats and you bring them in a wet market and you got them in these chicken boxes, things you put live chickens in. Then you got some civet cats and you got some pangolins and you got some other stuff all stuffed in chicken boxes. And they're all there stacked on top of each other, peeing and crapping on each other. That's just getting ready for a real mess. You see, the problem is you're taking animals that in the wild do not coexist, and you put them together. You got them in chicken boxes in some yucky place. I've been in those wet markets. It's disgusting. There's a reason why we have to have some food safety rules.
Temple explains how she visualizes the immune system when it's attacked by COVID and what she's learned about how to treat the virus.
I like to kind of imagine if my body's a military base, I've got an immune system to protect me. I got soldiers on that military base to protect me. Now, if a virus invades or a bacteria invades, I got soldiers go out there and they're gonna, you know, defeat the virus. Okay, hopefully that happens. Everything's fine. But what seems to happen in COVID, you get maybe a week, 10 days into it, you think you're getting better, and all of a sudden you get worse. Well, what's happening is the bad guys have overrun the base. You got some really stupid soldiers in your base, and they get confused, and instead of protecting you, they start lighting the barracks on fire. It's an autoimmune, a massive autoimmune reaction. That's what kills. It's called the cytokine storm. Now, most people just get over it. This doesn't happen. Now, there's a few people where this just takes them out. So when you look at drugs, and I'm not going to mention names because they've turned into political hot potatoes. So I'm only going to mention principles. There's kind of three kinds of ways you can go at it with drugs. If you just have a mild case, you take nothing maybe. But, okay, early in a viral invasion, any viral invasion, you can throw antivirals at it. That's a particular class of drugs that fights off viruses. Okay, but now let's say you start to get soldiers to burn the base. There's another set of drugs that are anti-inflammatories, but they're sort of more specialized, and they might be able to stop the soldiers when they first light the first fire in the barracks. There's about five of them, and they're on the shelf at the local pharmacy. Then I'll mention one drug name, and that's dexamethasone, because that now has a placebo-controlled trial. That's a drug of last resort, because it's a scorched earth, knock out all your troops. Now, if you took that too early, you knock out your soldiers, you could be really in trouble. You could get a bacterial invasion, that'd be the end of you. So you only take dexamethasone when you're headed for the ventilator. Now, getting ready to put the ventilator on you, that's when you take dex. And it saves like 20%, roughly. But it's a drug of last resort. They've tried a lot of drugs on you in the hospital, or they don't work. And then, of course, you got some expensive drugs. You got that expensive Remdesivir, that Ebola drug, expensive. Difficult to manufacture. It doesn't even work as well as dex. It's a cheap drug. It's been around for a long time. But where they've done research trying a whole bunch of stuff on patients when they land in the hospital and they're really sick. And a lot of the stuff doesn't work. But the thing where the research hasn't been done is what about medications to treat when the soldiers first start to go berserk and they start to light the barracks on fire? In other words, when the cytokine storm is starting. Now, the problem you've got with doing an experiment there is you don't take this when you first get it. And you don't take it after you're in the hospital and you're really, really sick. You take it when the soldiers first light the fire. Now, so how do you time it? I've read deep scientific articles on timing giving these drugs, and you give them right when the first light the fire. So how do you time that when you're at home? You're not quite sick enough to go to the hospital. Well, I've had flu where I get the flu and then a week later I thought I was getting over it and then I got whammied again. It's sort of, you're a week to 10 days into it, you think you're getting better, then you get whammied. That's when you might try one of these other medications. But that's a hard experiment to do, because how do you do the timing? You'd have to have the drug at home and then have a nurse or a doctor calling them up and figuring out when it's time to start taking the medication. And that research has not been done. They've done research, throw drugs at it in the beginning, try to prevent it. Let's throw the whole pharmacy at them when they're in the hospital and half dead. And you've got two drugs that work, Remdesivir and Dexamethasone, which actually works better. But doing some of these other things sort of more in the middle, that's the thing that needs to get researched. And it's not been done. Well, of course, I'm researching it because I'd like to not die. I've been super careful about COVID. I just have certain people I meet with. I've got other people I meet with outside being really, really super careful. But we need to be finding how to stop the cytokine storm, the massive autoimmune reaction, before it's sort of like you have to give these other meds right when the barracks first gets lit on fire. They don't work once the base is in flames.
The dominant strain of coronavirus that is currently circulating across the world appears to be more transmissible than the original virus that emerged in China. According to a new study published in the journal Cell on July 2, the new variation of the virus infects human cells more easily. And it seems to replicate better, meaning more copies of the virus can invade the body. It is also suspected that this new strain is less lethal, but it is still too early to tell if this will all prove true.
Then the virus is mutating. So this is getting, you know, more and more dicey. And then most people just get over it. I've talked to a guy, he got inside a cab of farm equipment with somebody else that had it in that car, and he got it. Now they took the farm equipment and locked it up in the garage, and everybody's scared to drive the farm equipment now because it had COVID inside the cab. But you need to avoid indoor confined spaces. That's where you get it. People close together, indoor confined spaces. That's absolutely the worst. And so if you have a person that's got COVID and then you're in a car with them, or you're at a bar jammed together, or you're at a meat plant or some other factory just jammed together. And actually, the locker rooms are probably worse than the plant itself in terms of spreading it around.
Do you think this is more contagious than the regular flu virus?
It's very, very, very contagious. But it seems to be the main area of contagion, it seems to be a confined airspace with somebody who's infected. You know, like in those big demonstrations, very few people got infected. Outdoors, and they kept moving. Yeah, you see, that was protective. And then the masks prevent other people from getting it from you.
How much time would you say you've spent a day researching COVID-19?
Well, I now spend about 5 minutes a day looking stuff up. But in the beginning, I was getting deep into the journal articles because one of the reasons why I did it is it makes me less afraid now that I know that I've got some stuff to treat it with. There is now the drug of last resort. I'd like to try to treat it before I need the drug of last resort. But there's stuff sitting in the pharmacy that they need to be studying, and other countries that are, you know, low income, they're the ones studying some of the other stuff, cheap stuff that's sitting on the shelf that could be used to treat it before you get to the ventilator stage. One of the things is people are too hung up on viral load, and they're not thinking enough about how do we stop the autoimmune response that's killing. You need to stop it when they first light the first match in the military base. When the first barracks catches on fire, that's when you need to be throw in some of these cheap drugs that are right there on the shelf at it. And nobody's doing this research right now. not going to mention the names of the drugs because everybody goes completely berserk over it. Say, well, you're not a doctor. You shouldn't be even discussing this. Well, I am a trained scientist, and I'd like to save my own butt, for one thing. And I wish people would be more logical about these things. Now, getting back to some of these medications, there are anecdotal reports. Everybody just blows off, but I've actually collected them. When some of these other medications worked, they were taken at the stage of when the first barracks fire would have been lit. That's the common denominator. Now, you got to remember, in science, observation is where you first start in order to think up a hypothesis to do experiments. I'm going, okay, it seemed to work. What did they do? You see, the stage of the illness is really important.
Temple says she thinks like an engineer and solves problems with what she calls bottom-up thinking. This mental process starts with collecting data or observations about something you know nothing about, then finding the patterns and sorting them into categories. It is how she approaches COVID-19 research in her effort to help find simple solutions for many pandemic-related problems.
I just read an awful thing in the New York Times. There were hospitals that didn't even know how to set and adjust ventilators correctly. Ugly statistics. You go to a good hospital, you put on a ventilator, you have a 90% chance of living. You go to a crappy hospital, they're killing 1 out of 3. And they don't know how to set ventilators. You know, that's pretty terrible. But I like to always, one thing I learned in engineering, and I basically have an engineering mentality. How do you solve a problem? Let's think simple. What are simple things, you know, other, some really good research comes out of low-income countries because they're going to try to figure out how to treat it with simple stuff that you can manufacture, that you can make. You see, that's the other thing I think about. I think about, how do I get enough of this stuff? And for all these people out in the field, if you don't have stuff that's simple, people can't do it. I'm just appalled at what's going on with the research. We research expensive stuff when there's cheap stuff sitting right there on the shelf that might work. We need ways to work on stuff that's not expensive and not complicated.
Why do you think that we're not able to get there? And who's motivating that?
Well, because expensive drugs make money for you. Cheap drugs on the pharmacy shelf don't make money. Cheap old generics, you don't make money off of that. We've got people dying right and left because, you know, we're doing the research that makes money. And then you take a low-income country, they're trying to figure out how to use something off the shelf. But what we're not doing is figuring out how to predict when these cytokine storms are going to happen. I also found out about a really cheap blood test for this. Could be done with a finger prick. But I'm not a doctor. So I give out the names of this stuff. I get chewed out for this. But I am a trained scientist, and I'd like to keep my butt in one piece.
The blood test, is that a test for the antibodies or for the virus?
Well, it's a test that tells you you're starting to get an autoimmune reaction. It's, you know, finding new uses for old things that are simple. Just even in designing equipment, I said, think simple. It could be sitting right there. But the problem is to set up a proper control study is difficult. It's easy to give somebody a drug when they land in the hospital. That's easy to set up that experiment. But now I've got to figure out, I don't want them taking some of this stuff when they first get COVID. The timing. This is what the science shows.
She's been paying close attention to what's happening with the virus in the meatpacking plants. And it's something mysterious.
Weird stuff's going on in the meatpacking plants. You go in there, you test them. Half the place is infected. Over half of them have no symptoms. Then one or two people get blasted, and it's not necessarily the old ones. So then a kid in his 30s is blasted and in the hospital on ventilator. He lived. No, I can't tell you what meatpacking plant I've been talking to, but I've been talking to them. I have to keep that confidential. Okay. But there's something going on in there.
What do you think?
The parking lots are full. They're back online. Is it all full of sick people now? No, it's not.
And there's no potential of the cattle itself getting
No. Don't think about getting it from cattle. That's all nonsense. You're not going to get it from a meat.
Do you think that a lot of the people in the meatpacking facilities are asymptomatic, possibly because it's mutating?
That's the million-dollar question. And if I was a doctor, I'd be doing genomic testing in those plants. It might be very interesting. Nobody's done that. All I know is they're open, and it seems to have stopped. That's what's happened. Now the prisons are all full of it, guards and inmates. Yeah. Nobody's going in there and genomically testing any of that stuff. Because you see, those are environments where an entire population has got it. See, when it first came into this country, it killed a bunch of people in the plants. It was horrible. Back in March and early April, we had 8 people die in one plant. Awful. That's not happening now. And they're open and they're running. I don't know what's happening. And I'm at risk, so I'm not about ready to go in there. But something's going on there where they were shocked at the, and it was very expensive testing all these employees. They're not going to do it again. At the high level of no symptoms, infected with no symptoms.
Another problem she is trying to figure out is the difference in survival rates for patients on ventilators.
Okay, we got hospitals where only 1 in 10 dies on a ventilator, and crappy hospitals where 1 out of 3 is dying on a ventilator. Well, I want to get rid of stupid reasons like you don't know how to adjust the ventilator. Let's start step by step making simple procedures so that you drag some nurse out of retirement. She never even used a ventilator before. How do you set these things? You see, that's an engineering approach. Also, they were too quick to use them, too, is another mistake they made. You see, a bottom-up thinker starts looking at, all right, what really separates that good hospital from that crappy hospital and what it actually does? That's the first thing I want to look at. Stupid things like not knowing how to set ventilators? Well, then we're going to figure out a simple way to train people to do that. In industry, it's called process control. It isn't the building being prettier. That's not what separates a crappy hospital from a good hospital. What is that good hospital doing where they've got a 90% survival rate and the other one is losing a third of them? Now, there may be demographic factors with the patients, but I don't think that explains it all. You can run that through big statistics packages and you can figure all that stuff out. But they, you know, we got so many rules about privacy, it makes it hard to get the data. Now, and I've worked in industry. I worked on implementing the McDonald's animal welfare system. And I had a very, very simple evaluation system. Well, the thing is, the managers have got to get out of the office and find out what's going on in the field. I find out they don't know how to set ventilators. I want to find out exactly how these things work. And we're going to figure out how to not make that stop. So you've got to figure out at what point in the process are they really screwing up. They're using them way too quickly. That was one of the things they've learned. Maybe the crappy hospitals don't learn. I don't know. They've learned in hospitals that they have to do some aviation protocols, which doctors hate. Pilots have to do a checklist every time they fly. And they're starting to apply those principles in hospitals. A lot of surgeons don't like it. Ugh, they have a pilot in there telling them what to do. They don't like them. Pilots have to do it every single flight. Aviation has learned that that improves air safety. There's a reason for doing it.
Do you think we'll learn lessons from this then and how to move forward?
The problem is you've got a really uncoordinated response. The other thing is, you know, there's a lot of papers coming out that come out what's called a preprint server. It hasn't been through peer review. I review a lot of journal articles in my field in animal science. And I'll tell you the part I get into. Everybody else wants to go out and use the fanciest statistics. If you don't use RStudio, you're not cool. I can tell you, I don't know how to use RStudio and some of these other fancy statistics they've got now. But you do some simple little experiment, how about your method section? I go, you didn't tell me what breed of pig you got in your experiment. It can change the results. Or you didn't tell me what you fed it. That can change your results. That's the methods. And you get a lot of stuff in biomedical science where you get opposite results on studies. It goes back to methods. Something as simple, did you shake your cancer cells really hard like this? Or did you just stir them? That can change the results of the experiment. So then you got to tell me, what machine did you shake them with? And so, and a lot of people aren't looking enough at the methods. Some very simple things with the methods that are easy to visualize. They're going crazy on statistics, but you've got to make sure the data you put into that statistics program is accurate data.
Temple recommends a hands-on approach that she learned from years of experience.
When you've been out in industry as long as I've been out in industry and you see what goes on in the field, the suits better get out of the office. You have to make things simple. Now, my system for measuring animal welfare at the meat plant worked really well and we got them really good because it was simple. Simple like traffic rules are simple. My grandfather was an inventor. He co-invented the autopilot for airplanes and he did it with a guy named Andrew Nikian who was probably autistic. We came up with this crazy idea of 3 little stationary coils that everybody thought was crazy. My grandfather made it work. It was really simple with no moving parts. There's simple drugs out there that if we learn how to use them, that, you know, developing countries can actually manufacture. That's what we ought to be doing. But we got to figure out how to use this stuff. Okay. I have a saying I used to say on engineering. This is a bad thing to say, but it's true. I've been in industry for over 40 years. Never underestimate the laziness or the stupidity of people operating equipment. Not implying that people working on the front lines of COVID are lazy. They definitely are not. But you have to design things, not for the smartest person. What you've got to do is figure out how to calibrate these things in a simple way that anybody can do in any country. That's approaching, I'm approaching it now as a designer. First of all, let's figure out how to treat people so we don't have to use ventilators. They learned that they overused them in the beginning. See, I'm approaching it as a designer. How do we figure out how to deal with this with stuff that's simple? Now, the really simple thing we could have done, you know, in March would have been shutting off the air travel. That would have controlled it in the beginning.
As a result of the pandemic in the U.S., pharmaceutical supply chains are vulnerable, and changing where many common drugs come from isn't out of the question. It is another angle of the pandemic Temple has scrutinized.
Raw materials are made in China from just a few factories. The pills are made in India. Now, you can stockpile a certain amount of these materials, but then if you run out of the stockpiles, then you're in trouble. It's a narrow supply chain. Now, the thing is, when you have a supply chain like that, it's really inexpensive, but it's easily disrupted. We have capability here to manufacture a lot of this stuff, but it costs more money. Common, everyday, ordinary medicines for ordinary stuff, like antibiotics, blood pressure pills, just ordinary stuff.
The disruption of the meat and dairy supply chain due to COVID resulted in the slaughter of thousands of pigs and tons of wasted food and milk. That hit close to home for Temple. And of course, she has clever solutions, thanks to her visual mind.
The meat industry got really messed up. It's now recovered, but there was a horrendous waste of food. Horrendous, especially in pork industry. The pigs having to be destroyed and just thrown away. Disgusting waste of food. And some of it bureaucratic, stupid reasons. So a dairy's dumping milk because a school package can't be sold at Safeway or some other store. I don't want to hear about that bureaucracy. You know, we've got to set up contingencies. So if restaurants close, you just divert that food service truck over to the grocery store and you're going to get weird stuff in there, like you're going to get milk cartons full of liquid egg. And you put it in a dairy case and you put a sign on the glass door that says, what's this weird product? It's liquid egg. It's restaurant packaged liquid egg. This is how you use it. Scramble it, use it in baking. This much equals one egg. It's that simple. You just sell us stuff. Local is going to be more expensive, but much more robust and less prone to disruption. The problem you got in the meatpacking plant is okay, if half your staff's sick from COVID or something else, I can't cut the meat up and make all the little value-added products. But what it can do, and the problem where they had to euthanize pigs and throw them away, was a regional problem. You see, on the East Coast, they were selling entire pig carcasses to China. I can have missing half the staff in the plant, and I can do that because I just cut it up three big pieces, throw it in forklift-sized boxes called combos, freeze it, ship it over there. That's easy. They know what to do with it on the other end. Now, what do I do in the Midwest? And I've got, you know, like entire giant pig hams and things like that. I've got to find outlets for that. There are certain communities where you could go in New York, back up with a truckload of that, sell it out in an hour. The military bases, they've got industrial-sized kitchens. They'll know what to do with it. And you could get meat science students to work in the grocery store and cut the stuff up. See, the problem I got with pigs is when they're ready, they're ready. Cattle, I can divert the pasture. I can slow them down because they're a grazing animal. But pigs, when they're ready for market, they're ready for market. And then when the packing plant's messed up because it's running at half speed, then they backed up the pigs. And the amount of pigs that were just destroyed and thrown away is like awful. It was awful. So the contingency you need to have for that is find outlets for just cutting that meat up into great big pieces And then you can run the plant with half the staff. What you have to do is build flexibility in on both ends of the supply chain.
According to her good friend, Rosalie, Temple lives to work.
Just finished updating my animal welfare book. I've got a new book on procedures at meat plants and slaughter procedures that just came out. I'm going to update my genetics book. I'm going to write about why visual thinking is important, because visual thinkers see solutions to problems. They can also see where there's a problem. You can see where there's a hazard. We need visual thinkers.
Lucky for us, in her spare time, she joins other leading visionaries in the quest to solve COVID-19 problems. We can all breathe a sigh of relief knowing that Temple Grandin is safe at home and thinking up for all of us so that we can live in a more humane and efficient place. Coming up in part two, the impending extinction of turtles and tortoises. Their fate is in our hands. For SQ Radio, I'm Sherry Quinn.